The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
Now on view at Skadfesh, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at scadfash.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. We'll spend this hour with artists who express themselves in two different forms. Doug Pisick is an Atlanta-based master woodworker. He creates sculpture, wall art, turnings, and decorative boxes. His most recent works are in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Later this hour, he'll talk about the body of work he calls Art for Our Unusual Times. Christopher Isherwood was a celebrated 20th century author best known for his Berlin stories, which became the basis of the musical Cabaret. The opening of Isherwood's Berlin Stories reads, "I am a camera with its shutter open, quite passive, recording, not thinking." The words, "I am a camera," could apply to the life of photographer Annie Leibovitz, though she is never passive and always thinking. If you were to close your eyes and picture John Lennon, Queen Elizabeth, Serena Williams, or just about any celebrity or head of state from the last 50 years, chances are you'd conjure an image that was shot by Annie Leibovitz. Leibovitz stopped by our studios during a book tour a few years back. We spoke about her career, her life, and her evolution as an artist.
Photography was my life. Everything was so interesting. Every single, you know, situation you walked into or was different and interesting and really amazing. It's so interesting you're bringing that up because what happened is, you know, David Hockney came along with his his studies on perspective and, his photo montages where there were many photographs. And it was really sort of groundbreaking to me because it was really how the eye sees. The eye doesn't just see in a rectangle or a square. It sees a little to the right, a little to the left. And you see more peripheral. And, you know, I used to, you know, sort of look peripherally out of the sides, you know, when things were going on all the time to make sure I was getting something. But you could never get everything into that frame. It was really, really, really hard. For 2 or 3 years, I actually took photographs inspired by Hockney. I took photographs, I shot to the left and I shot to the right, and I put them together. And it was quite fascinating to, like, broaden your vision like that. Of course, it was useless for spontaneity, you know, because something would be happening in the left frame and something would be happening in the right frame and they never quite went together. But so I stopped doing that. But I just think it's I can't help but think of what you're asking me literally because the frame, you know, I admired as a young person Robert Frank and Cartier-Bresson, who used the rectangle to, you know, they were geniuses. They the 35 millimeter, they composed in that rectangle, and I try so hard to do to the decisive moment, you know, that Cartier-Bresson talked about, and I was just useless at it. I mean, I really don't know if I believe in the decisive moment for, you know, for myself anyway, because life is more like a movie. You know, there's more like things are going on like all the time, and I it's always been hard for me to stop into a single image. But that is where I love my magazine work, because I love the series. I love, you know, 5 or 6, 7 photographs to tell a story. I mean, I understand, you know, I came to terms with creating a single image, you know, primarily for those covers of Rolling Stone early on. Believe it or not, at the end of the 70s, being asked by Life magazine to do a series of poets, you know, Tess Gallagher and Robert Penn Warren. And I started to think about how I could photograph a portrait of them and really emulate their work. Their, you know, how could I see their poetry in these photographs? Oh, anyway, here's the bottom line. Photography is big. It's huge. It's immense. It's broad. It has so many different ways you can use it. And I really do think of myself as a conceptual artist using photography now. You know, it's really like I'm not too sure after doing this for so long that I'm one kind of photographer.
Yeah. When you mention Penn Warren, you photographed him and wrote that he had been writing a lot about death.
Mm-hmm.
And you have him shirtless,
mm-hmm.
and just appearing gaunt and almost mm-hmm. raw. I think you did capture the moment.
That's very nice. Do you know, I'm not too sure. I don't think anyone else, I really felt like no one else ever understood the picture, because it looked like a man with no shirt on, you know, sitting on a bed. And it really was about, and he was so, so at peace. I mean, he was so, it was something that one could only hope when it's time for oneself that one would feel that much at ease and at peace. Actually, you know what? I personally love getting older, because I think that is sort of falling into place. How about you?
I'm loving it.
Aren't you?
I'm loving it.
No one talks about it enough.
Well, you know, the muscle tone, I wouldn't mind.
I'm wearing my fat pants today. It's like,
Yes, it's liberating.
It's quite interesting. I mean, it's really, you kind of know what you're doing. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be good, you know, every day or whatever. But it's just wonderful to know what you're doing. And you slow down, and it's feels so natural. It's not, you know, you're not running to any place anymore, you know. I know that maybe that doesn't sound great to some people, but I'm so...
You are at peace, and you have three terrific kids, and
that's
they
the only
keep
part,
you young.
That's the only part I didn't quite figure out right.
100%. Oh, well. No,
but,
you
no,
have
I
that.
Love, I love my... Oh, God, I love my girls. I mean, I love them. It's just it does make you want to be around longer. You know, that's the only little hiccup, you know, having done it late in my life, you know.
There's no predicting. I mean, look at Cartier-Bresson. Wasn't he 95, 99?
There is a funny riff among photographers that, you know, as a profession, there's a lot of longevity in it, you know, Lartigue and, you know. But,
so there you go. You picked the right.
I don't know. But then you have those Rolling Stone years that, like, sort of took, I think, subtracted a few
they
years.
They are behind you, Annie.
I know, but they certainly took a lot out of me. I mean, listen, you know, had an extraordinary time.
It launched your career.
Yeah. No, I mean, I you know, you have to believe that I had no idea I had a career. I mean, I was really just working. And I really worked. That first book, 1970, 1990. 1990 was the first time I went out. So I was working for almost 20 years, and I went out to talk about the book, and it was the first time that I realized that people were looking at my work. I mean, I was so engaged in my work. I was in a vacuum. I really had no idea that people, were that aware of my work.
And you said that you thought of yourself as a photojournalist rather than a photographer because the narrative was so important. When did you transition to photographer, or do you still think of yourself as storyteller?
Of course, one would love to be able to tell a story. I don't know if it's fair to try to tell a story in one photograph, though. That's why I appreciate the photo story. I still think we need what Life magazine was doing for us, which you had the photo story. Actually, I'm seeing it now. It's quite an interesting time. The New York Times, and the Washington Post, I mean, they are running picture stories. And they are our new magazines. They really are. I mean, the New York Times, usually on Sundays, they take several pages in the back of the first section and they run these kind of riveting photojournalistic stories. And they give them, a lot of space, not small. They take over, they go over the page. I mean, over the two pages. I'm just riveted with what I'm seeing journalistically today. It's so powerful to me. That's the best photography we have right now is our journalism. I mean, I've come from another world, but I still love seeing, running to the back door and getting the paper and love seeing the photographs in the paper. And I love seeing how the front page is laid out, and where they when they put something below the fold. And photography is certainly not going away, and neither is it's stronger than ever. And how we see it. I mean, it's hard because it does look really good on the screen. I mean, it really does look good on the screen, and to try to print it is really a little difficult, and it's a learning curve. But we're gonna get there. We'll get there. I love books. I mean, books are so important to me.
I love that in talking about your portrait of Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi as the Blues Brothers, you reveal that painting them blue was a bold move they weren't entirely on board with. In fact, Belushi walked out and you said he didn't talk to you for 6 months after
that. That's right.
And you go on to write that you did a lot of that kind of thing when you were young and cocky, but you wouldn't even know how to do it now.
It's not so much that I wouldn't know how to do it now, as I think it has something to do with being older. I don't think that that's the kind of photograph I would think about taking. Not that I'm not interested in conceptual work. I just did this series for Vanity Fair on the Hall of Fame, and Hannah Gadsby. We took a photograph that the comedian. I can't even call her a comedian. She's just a genius.
Mm-hmm.
But she sent me a photograph of a copy of Picasso's painting of Gertrude Stein as a reference idea, because I was sending her, we were emailing back and forth, and I used that portrait of Picasso's, portrait of Gertrude Stein as a kind of a reference picture for photographing Hannah. But it had a lot more to, as an idea for Hannah. I don't know if you know her work at all.
I am familiar with her, and I agree, she's brilliant. And heartbreaking and funny. I mean, it's extraordinary.
I think what was interesting about the painting, because I was thinking that I was going to go into that sitting with her a little bit, not exactly like a dying artist, but, you know, just very straightforward, you know, like a very, very straight, like an August Sander, a very, very straightforward, you know, image. And then she sent me the painting, and I realized what she was talking about was the integrity in Gertrude Stein, you know, sitting there, that, you know, that there was something very, you know, and you know, the story is that Gertrude Stein, of course, didn't like the painting at first when it was done. And then Picasso said, you know, like, wait 20 years, you know, you're going to like it. So
talk about young and cocky. Yeah. Studs Terkel came to my mind when I thought about the title of your book, At Work. And though your subjects aren't a tribute to workers, the title suggests a sort of utilitarianism. Mm. Is that how you think of your work, Annie? Less an artist and more a worker?
Well, you know, when I did At Work, you know, I was always enamored with Ansel Adams. He did a book called Examples, and he had taken 40 of his photographs and deconstructed them. They were case studies of how he made the photographs. And, you know, being around as long as I've been around, I would be besieged or talked to by young photographers about how I did my pictures. And I thought, you know, I think it's time to maybe write about, talk about, you know, the making of some of these photographs. And I thought maybe I was going to have 10 photographs, you know, and it turned out to be over 100 photographs in this book. But it was really done as a primer for young photographers. What I tried to explain is that there's just no secret way or magic way to do your work. That is going to be work, you know, and that, you know, you have to do it. I mean, it's just there's no magic or secret. It's just work. So that's why the title.
If you are just joining us, we're listening to a conversation with photographer Annie Leibovitz. We'll return after a short break here on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at ourgeorgiacoast.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. We're revisiting a conversation with the photographer Annie Leibovitz. Among the many famous photographs she's captured, one of her best known first ran on the cover of Rolling Stone. The photo was of John Lennon, nude, lying next to Yoko Ono. It was taken just hours before Lennon was killed by a gunman in New York on December 8th, 1980.
That's another interesting thing about photography is that the image, you know, it changes. It can change after someone dies or leaves you. It has a different meaning. It's true, I guess, with John and Yoko as well.
I was hoping to ask you about that, Annie, because there's this heart-achingly beautiful story attached to it. And would you talk about how the meaning of that photo changed after you took the picture?
Well, I had gone to photograph John for a cover of Rolling Stone, and I was actually told as I was, you know, basically going out the door that, you know, Jan Winter didn't want a photograph of Yoko. He just wanted a portrait of John for the cover.
This is the editor
of Rolling Stone.
Of Rolling Stone.
And you know, I knew John. I mean, I didn't know him, but I, you know, I've known him over 10 years. I had photographed him earlier for Rolling Stone. So it was 10 years. I think of this photograph as almost 10 years in the making. They had just come out with an album called Double Fantasy, and they're kissing on the cover. So I was very, I personally was very enamored with that. I loved the idea of romance, you know, and I loved the idea of their relationship. But I walked into the apartment in the Dakota, and I told John that, I didn't say it. I walked into the apartment, and he came up and he said, you know, we have to have Yoko in the picture. Yoko has to be on the cover with me. And I said, well, if we're going to do that, we got to do something really good, you know. So, and I told him about my idea of them embracing each other. And I imagined they were both going to be nude. And because it wasn't unusual, John and Yoko were nude. And at the last minute, Yoko didn't want to take, was willing to take her shirt off, but not her pants. And so I said, well, why don't you leave everything on? And then, so John, curled up next to her, and I took a couple of Polaroids and pulled the Polaroids. And John said, oh, this is our relationship. This is us. And so I took just a few frames, really, and then left the apartment. And I was maybe going to meet up with them later at the recording studio. They were going out. And then Jan Winter himself actually called me in the evening and said someone who matched John's description was taken, you know, to the hospital. He was shot. And then I spent the rest of the night up at the hospital, you know, waiting to hear. Here's a photograph that was taken with one idea in mind, and then John is killed, and it has another, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but I mean, because I don't want to describe it necessarily. You may want to do that, it takes on other meaning.
Last kiss.
A goodbye, yes, a goodbye. Jan, of course, ran it on the cover.
Annie, you write that the most important thing a young photographer can do is learn how to see. Mm. How did you learn that lesson?
Again, just doing it over, you know, taking pictures and going back to the darkroom and developing the film and printing and looking. I mean, I was very lucky because I had the darkroom, and I actually don't know how young photographers can have that, you know, experience, because it was so beautiful to go into a darkroom and, you know, the lights be off and you see, you know, the image just come up in the tray and in the chemicals. And
it's magic.
That was magic. It really was magic. As I became more busy, it became harder and harder for me to go back into the darkroom. I used to try to get into the darkroom once a year, but it sort of, you know, fell by the wayside. But so how do you see? You see by continuing to take pictures and looking at what you do. I mean, I was very lucky. Also, I had B.F. Feitler. He was a great art director, that sort of mentored me, and she told me I had to edit my work, you know, that I had to learn how to edit my work. And I didn't really, you know, we just go and we take pictures and pictures and pictures, but, you know, you have to stop and you have to edit. And it took me years to understand what was a good picture and what was not a good picture. And don't ask me what a good picture is. I don't. But that's what the books are. You see, the books are to me, you know, 1970, 1990 was the first time I stopped and looked at my work. And then 1990 to 2005 were the years I, you know, was with Susan Sontag, and that was Photographer's Life, and that was an edit.
These are memoirs.
When I called Fiden and said, I want to do this book, I had this idea. I knew what the ending was going to be, and it was going to be, you know, the last picture I was going to take for the book was going to be Hillary Clinton in the White House. And then that didn't happen. And I floundered, actually. I called Fiden and said, I can't do the book. I don't have an ending. And you see at the end of this book me kind of trying to figure out what an ending could be. But, you know, like everyone else, I've picked myself up and we've picked ourselves up and making our way, as they say.
You were the first American to be asked by Buckingham Palace to make an official portrait of the Queen. Big damn deal.
Big damn deal. But I did find out finally, because, you know, I went back to do another sitting with the Queen for her 90th birthday. So I had, you know, pulled myself together and I asked the press office, I said, why did the Queen ask me, you know, to take her picture, you know, the first time? And the press office officer told me, she said, well, Annie, you wrote her a letter and asked her if she would sit for a picture. This was like when I was working on the Women's Project with Susan Sontag in 1999, and we thought maybe the book was going to be about maybe women more from, you know, around the world. And I did send her a letter. It was five to 10 years earlier I had written her this letter asking if I could take her picture. So it's just a nice little story for young photographers. If they want to take someone's picture, they send them a letter. Eventually, that may happen.
Now they'd send an email. Who knows if it would reach the Queen.
That's true.
Well, here's this huge tribute to you and your work. And while you had to put up with some absurd demands, ultimately she won you over.
Oh, she was fantastic. She was incredible. I mean, if you can imagine, she was wearing 75 pounds of robes, and I also found out later that that we think we interrupted her favorite daytime TV show. So that was the other.
Tell us what it was.
No, I don't know what it was. But in any case, she does watch TV a lot. But
The price is right.
Have you watched The Crown, by the way?
Yes.
I mean, I wish I had seen that before I photographed her, because I sort of believe in it in some way. What was so sweet about the second time I went to take her portrait for her 90th birthday, because what was so charming is that the ideas for for that second time were her ideas, and it was so sweet. She wanted to be photographed with Princess Anne. She wanted to be photographed with her dogs, and she wanted to be photographed with her grandchildren. So she didn't say anything about Prince Charles or Prince Philip. It was like.
Talk about nutmegs.
And we did that. We did those three pictures for her. That's what she wanted.
I loved your takeaway, what you write about the very end of the photo session. What struck you so powerfully? You wrote about duty.
Well, we know more about that now, because there's been a lot more talked about, you know, about that. But at that time, I was new to me to understand her, you know. I mean, when I did my research for her, she was probably the most photographed person in the world. You know, I mean, there was so much material, you know, to look at over all those years. But no, she definitely, and that sitting was sort of talked about a lot, because the BBC had portrayed it as if she had walked out of this sitting. Quite the opposite. She had walked into the sitting very, very determined. And, you know, she was a live one. She was very feisty, and it's like I loved it. I mean, I remember the sitting was over, and I told the press officer, I said, "Oh my God, the Queen was incredible." But no, she has such. That's why she was so angry, is that she would never have walked out. You know, she just has such a strong sense of duty in what she's doing, and she didn't stop until I said thank you very much. She did not, you know, say it's over. She was like she was waiting, you know, and until I said, you know, thank you.
The queen was waiting for your command,
well, I mean,
Annie Leibovitz.
We had a certain amount of time, you know, and I kept it within that time, and then, you know.
And your little girl and Sarah got to curtsy for her?
She did, yes.
Do you have photos of that?
I don't have photographs of that, but I think it's in that BBC documentary.
Okay. She'll let
they
you
got
know.
They got to meet her again the second time we photographed.
With the advent of Instagram and the ubiquity of selfies and telephones, do you think that's something good for photography, or does it annoy you?
Well, we're talking about two different things. Well, one is, you know, the Instagram account, which is I have never crossed over. My girls do have their own, you know, friend chats, you know, but I have never. I've always had a place to place my photographs, so I never used Instagram myself. But you cannot underestimate the convenience of having, you know, a phone in your pocket, a camera in your pocket. It is just accessible and available. And, you know, that is really, you know, the difference between taking the photograph and not taking the photograph. And I'm a big advocate of the cell phone. I think cell phone camera. I just think it's wonderful, and I love it for my children. First of all, I really love photography so much. The fact that my children can take pictures of their friends and, you know, things that are going on in their lives, and they can sort of see themselves and come to terms with who they are through imagery like that. I just think, again, photography is so broad and big. There's room for all of this. You know, there's no reason to say, there can't be all these kinds of photographs. You know, I remember, I've said this before, but, you know, going in to see Vanessa Redgrave backstage, and she pulls out her phone and she shows me her grandchildren. So, you know, I think I love the, you know, the camera phone. I think it's great for everyone. It's very democratic. I love it.
Well, I wish you the longevity of Cartier-Bresson. And so,
for my children's sake, thank you. You know what? Here's the other thing. I love what I do. I love what I do. And I am committed to it. And it's so interesting. History just takes over. You know, the body of work is so interesting to me. I can stand outside of it, and it only gets, you know, more interesting. So,
I adore the photo of your mom.
So I talk about this photograph of my mom when I'm asked about my favorite photograph, and one of the reasons I talk about it is because it sort of raised the bar. I mean, I can't achieve that kind of intimacy in my day-to-day work, you know, that I do. It's really your family and your friends where you have that kind of very special, you know, work. And this was done for the Women's Project with Susan Sontag for 1999. But it was a difficult sitting because my mother wanted my mother looked uncomfortable at first. And I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "Well, I don't want to look old." And how do mothers know? They have that intuition. I don't know what it is, but I wanted to make sure my mother looked her age. You know, I was interested in that, and but what struck me the most about this photograph after all was said and done is I realized when I look at my mom in this photograph, I really feel like there's no camera there. You know, she really is looking at me. And I remember the women's show in hanging at the Corcoran in Washington, D.C., and someone said to me, you know, your mother really loves you. And I'm looking at it and I said, no. I'm looking. I said, you're right. She really does love me.
There it is. Validation okay. On the wall. It's just as powerful a photo as any of them.
Yeah. I use it as an example, really. I mean, I think my favorite portraits of all time are Stieglitz's photographs of George O'Keefe. They're just, they make me so weak. I mean, because, you know, they were married, they were in love. She was a great muse. She loved, you know, she loved to sit for him. And he was a great photographer, and what a great combination. And those photographs are just extraordinary. So it's that intimacy. I mean, you see it in Sally Mann's pictures of her children. That work is only there. You know, I mean, that's only in that kind of intimacy.
Photographer Annie Leibovitz, talking about her book, Portraits, 2005 through 2016. There's more of City Lights ahead on WABE Atlanta. Marietta-based artist Doug Pisick is classified as a master woodworker from the Woodworkers Guild of Georgia. He has received numerous awards in national juried exhibitions, and his works can be found across the U.S. in European and Israeli collections. He joins us now via Zoom. Doug, welcome back to City Lights.
Oh, it's such an honor to be back. Thank you so much for having me.
Your latest series is called Art for Our Unusual Times. What was the inspiration?
Oh, it's all the unusual things that we're all going through now as we're adapting to the current COVID pandemic. It's obviously been quite a bit of a challenge for literally everybody. And it's one of the rare times as an artist I've actually felt truly inspired to create something based on what was happening around me. And I created a series, which is currently three key pieces, which tie in on our attack on the virus and also the virus's impact to our body and our impact to our psyche or our mind. It's just something that's been running through my head, and I had to get it out in physical form.
How long did it take you to first envision and then create these three pieces?
Oh, it's interesting. Several months back, as I was just hearing and thinking about how we were trying to come up with viruses and attack, you know, what we have going on around us, I came up with an inspiration for my first piece, which is called The Cure. And that's our attack on the virus. And the inspiration for that was pretty much something I almost woke up and just said, I just saw a vision, and the vision was of a hammer slamming down and destroying the virus, which is a physical representation of what this art is. It's an actual spherical view of a virus with the little nodules coming out of it. And I created what looks exactly like a steel hammer, an iron hammer, pounding down and cracking it open. And I had the vision of it, but to physically make it was something that was very therapeutic, exciting, and I felt hopeful and inspirational for others, which is why I put this virtual exhibition together.
You mentioned that the piece is created entirely out of wood, including the hammer, or is the hammer metal?
It's including the hammer. It's actually, I have this large handheld iron, small miniature sledge, and that was my model. But the hammer itself is 100%, the hammer head is made out of maple, and is cut to look exactly like a hammerhead. And then it has an oak handle, which looks just like a regular tool handle. But I carved all of it myself with all my own tools.
So you craft by carving the individual parts. It's not as a sculptor would mold clay or chisel from marble.
Correct. It's actually very, it's very, very unique with, when you work with materials such as wood and others as well, but with wood in particular, which I've worked quite a bit with, it's often depend on what you're trying to make. It's actually appropriate to make things in sections and pieces. So for this, the hammer head was a single piece. The hammer handle was a single piece. The sphere was a single piece. And there's approximately 20 of these burl nodules that are wrapped around the piece. They're all individually done. The trick is to figure out how to design it in advance so that when you put it all together, it looks seamless. And in this case, somewhat realistic with the way it was all pulled together. I know it's difficult over the radio, but I do find that those that have seen it have all felt like it's been visually pops as to exactly what's been represented. And I'm actually very fortunate. The particular piece we're talking about now is actually shown in the current edition of Fine Art Connoisseur magazine.
Mm. Now, you have another piece in this series called Thoughts in Isolation. And I read that you created a social media campaign asking your followers to share one-word thoughts about their experiences in isolation due to the pandemic. What were some of the words you received?
Oh, there were so many that had come back to me. I'd received over 100 words of thoughts people had, everything ranging from fear to anger to the word vote, you know, which is so sad that people are thinking of this from political aspect as well as the physical aspect and all the mental aspect, because this pandemic is hitting everybody from every angle and every direction. What I wanted to do was to narrow it down to just 19 words, COVID-19, you know, obviously the symbolism there. I wanted to put as much symbolism into it as I could. And I picked 19 key words, which kind of symbolized a lot of what everyone had. It was everything from hope to fear to solitude to pensive. And I even have baking and booze are words that have shown up as well. There's so much, there's a reason there's no more flour on the shelves. And apparently booze has been a big factor as well for some individuals for the response. I just thought they were very appropriate, not only because of the thoughts people are having, but also, you know, the humorous aspect as well.
Did you receive a lot of repetitions of words? Did that help you narrow things down?
Yeah, interestingly, there were some. There were a lot of synonyms. You know, the words lonely and loneliness had shown up, you know, often, which is sad, but critically important to be thinking about. And I picked ones that just really stood out that were very much the basis, I think, that covered whatever happens with everyone. And what's interesting about this piece as well is that although it's talking about isolation, I felt it was important to reach out to the community to get the input. I wanted to get everyone's input. So in a way, this piece called Thoughts in Isolation was created in a non-isolated social media environment. And this piece is totally different looking than the first piece we talked about, The Cure. And that this one is made with about 50 intersecting, shifting wooden rods. And these rods make a mishmash. So just that looks, for me, it envisions thoughts racing through somebody's mind. And the thoughts themselves make up 19 of the rods, and they pop out. They're made out of a much different colored wood than the rest. So when you look at it, you can see how these thoughts are basically randomly and sporadically shooting through someone's mind along all the other thoughts that might be happening with them. It's a very dynamic piece. You can almost feel like you can see the synapses shooting through your head when you look at a piece like this.
The third piece is Angel Breath, which has a poetic name. It's also sad to view this.
Yeah, I think it's important to have the sadness as well as the hope and the happiness. It's a combination piece, but there's definitely sadness to it. This is our body's response, is what this one represents, and also very different than the others. This one was inspired by an earlier piece I had done, which was a heart and lung sculpture, which I was commissioned to make for a pulmonologist, not surprisingly. But this particular one is a bit different. It does look like a pair of lungs, which are encapsulating a heart. The heart, though, is more like a Valentine heart as opposed to a human heart. But when you look at it, there's a hole in the center of the heart, which, as I said, it's like it's having that feeling of a hole in your heart due to the loss of life and the attack and that people are having. Obviously, the lungs are critically important in what we think of when we think about what this virus is doing to us. But when people look at it, some see lungs and some see what looks like angel wings. Amazingly, the lungs have that look to them. And I did shape them a little more elongated to have a bit more of that feeling. And I feel that it's very important to have a piece that you look at, it shows love, but also shows the impact that it's having on us as a society and as individuals.
Doug, clearly you've been acting on your inspiration, having created these complex and thoughtful pieces. How has it been for you as an artist during COVID-19, aside from creating these pieces in response to the disease?
I'm glad you asked. You know, a lot of people aren't actually talking, except for you, of course, aren't talking about the art community. And what's happening to them. One of the galleries that was showing my work has shut the doors. It's very difficult for all businesses, obviously, with the impacts. And a lot of galleries and museums have put together virtual exhibitions. And for example, what we're talking about now is a virtual exhibition I put on my website so people can come and visit these three pieces. There's actually videos of all three pieces so people can see them in three dimensions and try to actually vision them being there in front of them. And it has been difficult, though, in general, because people have a harder time going and seeing the works. It's not just about the artists. It's about the people that appreciate the art. Both are suffering in a different way. But for those of us that are able to get virtual exhibitions out there and be able to share our works, no matter what they are, right now is about all we have going for us, and we really appreciate being able to do that in today's times. And although it's been difficult, I've also been very, very grateful that I've had the opportunity to be thinking of new ways of sharing the work that I create, which I had not thought about before.
Indeed. And for what consolation it may be, and I realize it could feel small, visual artists have the advantage of being in galleries or museums where people can social distance and there can be timed ticketed admission, whereas symphony orchestras, theaters, are facing tremendous challenges with how and when they can return to work.
It is very, very true. One thing I am grateful for, I've actually just entered a new gallery in Marietta, the Robert Kent Gallery, who is open as well and very careful about how many people can come in for viewing the arts. But Now, everyone knows I'm also affiliated with a wonderful dance company called Terminus Modern Ballet Theater, who I know you're aware of. And we had to cancel all of our performances, our live performances, but instead we're currently creating dance movies and films that people will still be able to enjoy and see. It's different, but it's still a way of being able to share. Symphony orchestras, some of them are showing online as well. However, you're right, there is nothing that matches being able to see performing arts in person, to experience it, and to experience the visual arts as well. And I'm grateful for that fact that we can do this today. But at the same time, I'm so looking forward to going out and seeing these things in person as well, and being able to experience the joy that you get for, as a group, as a society, for these performances.
Marietta-based artist and woodworker Doug Pisek. His latest series is called Art for Our Unusual Times. For more information on how to check out his virtual exhibition, go to our website, wabe.org/citylights. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of Atlanta arts and culture. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 11 to hear about High Visibility, a group exhibition of photographers featuring several Atlanta LGBTQ artists. Our producers are Summer Evans and Ryan McFadden. Kevin Rinker is our engineer, and I'm Lois Reitzes. I would just love it if you'd follow me on Twitter at LOISREITZES. You can also follow us on Facebook at WABE City Lights. Listen to past interviews and shows from our archives at wabe.org/citylights. And City Lights is now a podcast. Check it out wherever you subscribe. Thanks for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.